east, Yuma man to the east, Sandia man down by Albuquerque and so on. But man's continued existence, the first inhabitants of the San Juan Basin, man's continued existence in this area begins just about the time that Christ was walking on earth, just about the beginning of the Christian era. At about the time of the birth of Christ, there began moving into this area and living in this area a people whom anthropologists call basket makers. They call them basket makers because that was their foremost art, the weaving of excellent baskets. And they lived all over this area. They built houses by digging into a hillside and leveling out a platform, pushing the dirt down to the downhill side all of the time, and then roofing that over with brush, with rocks, with sticks, with bark, with anything that they had to roof it over with. Ordinarily, it was from 10 feet in diameter to 30 feet in diameter sometimes. And they used these baskets that they made as containers for all purposes, but they didn't possess any pottery, you see, like we have here on the table. They didn't possess the bow and arrow. They did have spears for defense, rather crude spears for defense and for the killing of small game and things like that. They did have the otel, or a dart-throwing stick. By the way, here is a handle of an otel that has been found. We don't find, and some other instruments used by early inhabitants of the San Juan Basin, awls and things like that. These are just interesting rocks that they happened to pick up that somehow, some way, fascinated them, as they might very well any primitive people. Their mainstay, though, was the raising of corn and squash up on the tops of the mesas around here. And they gathered, of course, wild nuts, wild seeds, grass seeds, wild fruits, anything that they could. We, of course, don't find too much evidence of these very early people because they did build their habitations on the side of a hill and the vagaries of wind and water erosion. And things like that. Erosion, yes, have washed them all away. But by the year 400, just about then, or to date it in historical times, about the time that the Roman Empire was falling pretty heavily, these people right in the San Juan Basin had progressed and developed into a culture known as modified basket makers by some anthropologists. And the remnants of this culture are what you find on the top of any mesa right around here in Durango. We're in one of the richest archaeological areas in the United States. Any amateur can go out on any day, on any mesa around here practically, and find evidences of these modified basket makers. Now, they continued to weave baskets. They continued to raise corn and squash on the mesa tops, but they lived right by where they were growing these things. They continued to build habitations by digging down about 3 feet into the earth. These are pit dwellers that I think anybody around here is familiar with. Yeah. Seen them restored over at Mesa Verde in many different places. They grew in population, this much is evident. They practiced agriculture to a very great extent, and apparently the population grew far more than anybody, historians and anthropologists, have been willing to admit, I think, up until this time. It is interesting that, for instance, in 1958, you remember when Shell Oil and several other oil companies built a pipeline out to Los Angeles from the Four Corners area. Right where the bulldozer went, they found 85 of these sites. And by the way, to the credit of the modern corporations, they had two anthropologists from the National Park Service right there to classify, identify before they ruined everything. And they developed, and they gradually developed pottery. They developed into a Pueblo-type people. And we have here on the table some examples of the pottery of the late basket makers and the early Pueblo people when they began to live actually in villages, several families together, several houses together, and then they continued to build a kiva, probably in remembrance of their earlier pit houses, but that became a ceremonial. place and where they lived in the wintertime, too. Legend sometimes becomes religion. Mr. Root has excavated a ruin last summer of this late basket maker, early Pueblo type, and he can tell us more about this than I can. He's had years and years and years of experience on this. Mr. Root, what can you tell us about some of this pottery here?
The term basket maker applies also to the fashioning of their pottery. For example, a big vessel like this was fashioned in a basket, and then the basket removed, or many times simply burned off of the pottery in the firing of it, leaving the specimen as you see here. This particular piece was found just outside of the limits of Durango to the north, and was turned up by a road grader that went through a basket maker ruin, which no one knew was there. Most of the basket maker pottery is plainware, but some of their bowls and a few of their pitchers and all were decorated. Some of them, as we have on a chart, were decorated rather elaborately. This is a very nice piece, but it's nothing particularly unusual, also demonstrating the ability of the basket makers. Now, this piece is not basket maker. It might fool you from the looks of it, but this is a couple of periods advanced from basket maker. This is way up into Pueblo II pottery, made at the same time these pieces were made. So you see, at times you can't tell merely from the appearance of pottery just what period it falls into. Now, this is the type of pottery developed right after the basket maker period. And frankly, I think Pueblo I will rival your classic Mesa Verde period when it comes to artistry. Perhaps the pottery itself may not be quite as good, but the brushwork is absolutely superb. Here you have a Pueblo I bowl. The lines are fine. How they could put those on with the implements they had is a source of constant marvel to me. And the bowl that Dr. Delaney is holding there again demonstrates. Personally, I think these two bowls would compare with any classic bowls of the later Pueblo III or Mesa Verde type. Of course, characteristic of Pueblo I is the gourd vessel, and many of these are two or three or four times as large as this, beautifully fashioned and beautifully decorated.
What do you think they used them for?
Yes, what did they use a pot like that for?
This could be used for practical purpose, simply pouring water, but when we're not sure, we always say they were used for sacramental purposes or something of that kind.
Of course.
So we'll leave it that way. We have to have an escape route somewhere.
I have a card here of some of the most excellent pottery found in this region. Unfortunately, only one of these pots is still in Durango. I believe two of them are at the University of Arizona. One of them is at Gunnison. And where is the other one, Mr. Root?
One is at Carnegie.
Carnegie Institute, yes.
Mm-hmm. The bowl up in the far corner that has the dancing figures on was excavated down below town by Mrs. Root several years ago. It's now in the collection on loan up at the Fort Lewis College.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But it's the only one of those five. I suppose those are five of the outstanding basket maker bowls in existence.
Yes,
and
I think so.
Of them found right here, and just one of them remains in this territory.
If we do enough excavating, as we hope to continue doing, in addition to the one you did last summer, Mr. Root, while we're talking about what you did last summer, as far as the excavation is concerned, you have two cards here. Would you want to say something about them?
We found our work last summer very, very interesting. First of all, because it was the first field work done by Fort Lewis College. And we feel it was very, very significant from that point of view. We hope that the program will continue. The lower chart shows the excavation as completed last summer with the help of a group of very, very outstanding students. We were able to excavate a kiva-type dwelling and the 12 rooms in a semicircle not far distant from the kiva-type dwelling. Now, to say that this is a kiva is not true. Mm-hmm. It's a forerunner of a kiva.
Yes.
But it's patterned after the kiva with a few exceptions. Instead of the 7 pilasters, there are 8 supporting beams here. The construction of the roof, I could not say definitely because the ruin was burned and burned very thoroughly. Inside of the kiva, we found specimens very much as they left them when they had to run. Quite a number of pieces of pottery and stone implements and all that kind of thing. When it came to excavating the rooms, we found 3 or 4 of the rooms quite productive, but apparently they had time to take the material out of the other rooms, and it was pretty much hard work and no results.
Yeah. And this is your reconstruction of how you think that ruin looked when it was inhabited. It's a very fine job. Don't laugh at that, Mr. Root. That's fine.
The only thing I'm certain about, Dr. Delaney, is this, that the original inhabitants would never recognize from that painting the place where they lived. I'm sure of that.
I think it's pretty good. I'd like for you to explain something else to me. Why is it, I notice when you come in and put pots together, you always get them whole. And when I try to put pots together, I always have great big gaps in them. I don't find all of the sherds or something like that.
Perhaps somebody gave you material with pieces missing, and I take the pieces, I'm sure.
And put them into yours, I see. This is very possible. Well, there are just thousands and thousands of these, this type dwelling, within a 25-mile radius of Durango. There are over 1,000 that have been cataloged. Isn't this true?
That's right.
Certainly, it's a rich archaeological area. Well, they continued to develop, and they began to build bigger villages. They began to use masonry or adobe, many different types of houses. The pottery was better. They domesticated the turkey, not for food, but for feather blankets, using that and chipmunk fur and anything else that they might have for those feather comforters or feather blankets, as they are called. They began to weave cloth sometime before the year 1000, and a very fine weave. And they learned to use the bow and arrow. They learned to kill animals for food and for the pelts. They continued to make practically everything that they might need out of the yucca cactus. And it's at this time, interestingly enough, when you find burials from the period shortly after 700, the back of the skull is flattened, indicating the use of cradle boards.
Right.
You can date some things from that.
You just mentioned weaving.
Yes.
When did they first grow cotton? Evidently, they had cotton in this country in the early days and wove it.
I don't know whether they grew it here, Arthur. Mr. Root might want to comment on this. I would have the idea they traded for it.
As far as I know, it was on a trade basis, but some of their weaving that goes way, way back, you would swear it was cotton or something of the kind, but it's not.
But it's not. It's yucca?
But it's no. Some of the best is yucca, but I can't think of the name of the plant right now, but it grows in this region. Mm-hmm. And they treat it similar to yucca, but made a very, very fine and soft cloth, and you would take it for cotton.
I've seen examples of that.
Yes, very beautiful.
Thought it was cotton, as a matter of fact.
Very beautiful.
In fact, some of it is labeled cotton, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. Some of it was mistakenly labeled that way.
Well, speaking of a great deal of this stuff being found right around Durango, I think one of the most famous of the items found around here was the one that Mr. Flora found up Fall Creek in the burial up there, and he found this preserved skeleton. They named her Esther.
Esther, you're talking
and,
about, yes.
She's now on display at
Mesa Verde. Yes.
And creates quite a bit of a comment. And that, she came right up here from Fall Creek Basin.
And I have the idea that there are just hundreds and hundreds more of these if we search long enough and arguably enough. I think no doubt about it.
Well, oddly enough, along with all this, somebody left pictographs and petroglyphs on the cliffs, and they've been aptly named, I think, since as Newspaper Rock and the like.
Yes.
But has any progress been made in deciphering or interpreting those rock petroglyphs or pictographs that you know of?
Well, gosh, the only thing I can think of offhand is the Book of the Hopi that I'm sure you've seen. You remember that by Frank Waters?
Yes.
Where he has figured out and also learned from the modern Indians quite a bit of the meaning of some of the petroglyphs and pictographs that are around the Southwest. Also, a little bit of work has been done on that in New Mexico from the work done in painted kivas and things like that. They've figured this out fairly well, I think.
Well, I've been wondering if a project like that, along with the excavation work being done by Fort Lewis College, might uncover some new and interesting theories regarding these newspaper rocks.
I think that's true.
It might very well. Here is another card done by Mr. Roots showing some of these unusual art designs and things like that used by some of the first inhabitants of the San Juan Basin. Mm-hmm. Another very fine piece of drawing. Symbolism and things like that certainly can stand right up to any of the modern art today, I think. Then
it really is amazing the capabilities of some of these ancient people. I find many inhabitants, Doctor, thinking of them in terms like you might think of the dodo bird, lacking intelligence, lacking a sense of keen reasoning. It's absurd. These people knew how to think.
Why?
And they knew how to create, and they knew how to desire and wish for better things, progress.
Man hasn't changed much.
Not
I
too
think
much.
Anybody could conclude that's done very much work in anthropology or archaeology. Certainly this was a thinking man and lived a pretty good life, wouldn't you say? Not the some of the comforts and some of the standards that we have, but they certainly had some beautiful places to live.
Yes.
And they knew how to keep warm and to clothe themselves and to get food. And what else, really?
Well, weren't they communal, too? They lived
together. Yes, they did. And,
pretty much in harmony within their own groups.
And not only with their own groups, but I think almost a perfect attunement with nature. Which is something maybe that today, in 1966, maybe we could learn a little bit for the mental health of the United States as space grows scarcer and wilderness becomes more valuable and so on and so on.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, some of these people have migrated, I expect, over large areas. I'm wondering where those people came from that built such ruins as Casa Grande in Mexico. And they had a lot of artifacts that were, a lot of the things they used were pretty much similar to ours, and it may have been they drifted down there.
It could very well. Well, we are pretty sure that, for instance, the people, after they left Mesa Verde, which we'll get to later, went down, and some of them lived side by side with the Hohokam. Mm-hmm. the Hohokam culture in Arizona. And very possibly some of them went further south into the area of northern Mexico and different places. It's pretty evident, too, that some of them are the ancestors of some of the pueblos in New Mexico, like San Ildefonso, Santa Clara, and San Juan, right around in through there, close to Espanola. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's one other thing that's always been interesting to me, too, and I've wondered about. Can the cultures, do you think, Dr. Root, down here in Arizona, among those Hohokams and among those, some of those others, be traced, a connection traced between them and the ones who occupied this area through either their artifacts or their tools, their implements, or things, or their, any pottery or things like that?
Well, Art, I am one of those who am not satisfied that all of our periods are represented by migrations from the north. I can't see it. I think that you go down to the far south, I can't for the life of me see how that ties in with these people up here. I just can't see it.
You mean the great cultures down in Mexico, the Mayan, the Aztec, Toltec, and
I just can't see all of that coming over Bering Strait. It, it just doesn't make sense to me.
I agree with you. I agree with you wholeheartedly.
I can't prove my feelings.
Well, I know that down in South America, in the mountains of Peru, up around Huancayo and some pretty isolated places in the Andes, that music that they play on reed-like things, if that isn't Oriental Polynesian type of music, I would eat my hat, as the modern commercial says. But I think certainly they came across many different ways, not just Bering Strait.
I feel sure of it.
And who knows about a land bridge at one time or a series of islands that have since disappeared. Look at how many have appeared and disappeared in historic times.
Yes, that's right.
Certainly they were around a long, long, long time. Came many different ways. I agree with you.
Well, I noticed, too, there's a difference in the features of these people. And that would indicate that they were of a different race than the ones that they, we tried to attribute all the Indians to.
This past summer, I was in Guatemala for a short time, and the people there certainly believe that a group of people came in who were much farther advanced culturally than the people that were living in Guatemala at the time, and they became the rulers. And these are the ones that you see on those big stone facades of the temples and the idols and things like that. They have a little bit different feature, those people say, than the inhabitants in Guatemala had.
That's right.
And I think that's very possible.
I think it's something that certainly bears investigation.
Yes, and artifacts found in Guatemala and the southern part of Mexico that certainly could be Egyptian. If they had been found in Egypt, there would have been no question whatsoever. And these are very similar. I'm certain that there's some link that we simply don't know about. Maybe from both ways, maybe from across the Atlantic and across the Pacific.
Well, don't you feel that the research in this work is just really beginning to scratch the surface, and that more information will come along as they begin to get these items compared and
Certainly.
Checked out?
And this is the hope of what we are trying to do at Fort Lewis and excavating these things every summer. We're going to know in a few years a lot more about the basket makers and the early Pueblos than we know right now, as soon as we have a lot more basis of comparison, and we soon will have that.
Sure. Well, there's a lot of that I know is ahead of us. Well, Dr. Root, do you have any plans now for more excavations?
Yes, Dr. Delaney and I are just waiting for
the snow,
the snow and the muddy roads to dry so we can go out and investigate some sites that we're contemplating using.
Do they look promising?
Very, very much. Haven't seen them, but they're very promising.
From
from reports, huh?
From reports, yes. an area, for instance, that was lived in much longer than this kiva-type dwelling that we excavated last summer. And that should have a lot more artifacts, just a lot more of everything. Mm-hmm. And if it's done as carefully as Mr. Root and those boys did this, we're going to have a pretty good basis for comparison before very long. As we do three or four of those, all the better. I think we'll have an outstanding collection of late basket maker and early Pueblo. We already have some very fine pieces, but this will become outstanding.
Good. Mm-hmm. Well, this evidently wasn't occupied too long then.
No.
I would say this burned down very, very soon after it was constructed. Yeah. Which,
well, you know, Dr. Delaney, I have here a little idol that came out of a ruin down in the state of Colima, Mexico. And that's a volcanic region, as you know.
Yes.
And the woman who owns a private museum down there and gave me this said that she found it about 100 feet under a lava flow a number of years ago and had many others. And since the state of Mexico prevents them from selling anything, she said there's nothing to prevent her from giving it away. And she gave it to me. And you know, I'd like to have the museum up at Fort Lewis have this little idol.
Well, thank you, Arthur. We'll certainly accept it and put it in the museum. You know, a lot of the pieces that we have up there are from donations just such as this. That are out there for students to look at, to learn from, where we can teach some anthropology to them and archaeology and everything else. It's valuable. Thank you very much.
We appreciate it.
It'll certainly be put in the museum, and of course your name will be put on there as a donor too. Thank you very much. That's pretty well done with the headdress, just like the Aztecs used to wear and everything.
That's a good example.
No question about it's coming from someplace down in that area.
No. You see, that's from southwest of Guadalajara.
Yes.
And on the west side of the Sierra Madre Occidental Mountains.
On the west, yes.
Yeah, and on those, that range that reaches out toward the ocean there.
Yes.
And those volcanoes, some of them are still active, at least still smoking.
Yes. And certainly there have been eruptions of that before the Spanish came into Mexico. I can understand that that would be under a lava flow without any difficulty at all.
Assignment 6 has brought you San Juan Heritage, produced by this station in cooperation with the Center for Southwest Studies at Fort Lewis College. Your hosts for this series, Dr. Robert Delaney and Mr. Arthur Wyatt, with their guest tonight, Mr. Homer Root. Tonight's program has been the first in a three-part series entitled The American Indian, First Inhabitant of the San Juan Basin. We invite your comments, we solicit your comments on this program. And we invite you to be watching in 1 month on March 22nd as our hosts dwell on Mesa Verde and the Wetherills. San Juan Heritage is directed by Mike Nikas. This is Jack Welch thanking you for joining us for San Juan Heritage.